Tell me a story.
Once upon a time, I thought my parents were real estate moguls. Oh, you know what, actually? Are you stoned right now? Or just tired?
Just tired.
Just a quick reminder, I was unwittingly born into a Northern California pot-smuggling family and didn't find out until I was well into my teens that my entire world could have come crashing down at any point because my seemingly straight parents were the kind of outlaws that Nixon's War on Drugs and Nancy Reagan's Just Say No anti-drug campaign would sentence to 20-plus years in prison if they were caught. So the vilification of pot has a long American history, and my dad's journey from LSD-loving college kid in Brooklyn to an epic bi-coastal pot smuggler is because of my mom. So let's start with my mom's story and her pioneering life in San Francisco's early 1960s counterculture scene. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter. Born in Oakland, my mom grew up in L.A. in the 1940s and 50s. She remembers all her Japanese neighbors disappearing during World War II.
Meat was scarce and butter was scarce. I never had butter until I was like in the 50s somewhere. Everybody wore gloves when you went out, and everybody wore stockings and girdles. It was like the whole society was constrained.
My mom's family moved from Mar Vista, a beach neighborhood along L.A.'s Prohibition Rum Runner Road, a.k.a. Venice Boulevard, to the San Fernando Valley in the 50s. San Fernando Valley, full of orange groves, was stifling for anyone who thought outside the box. And my mom has never fit in anyone's box, even though she is tiny. She lived a double life, as a socially acceptable cheerleader and prom princess, but also did modern dance and, shockingly at the time, was friends with non-white kids, including Richie Valens. Her mom, a Bay Area native, from a family of mostly little people, they were perfectly proportioned adults, but everyone was super tiny, like, you know, under 5 feet tall. They were little people. So my grandma was a discontent, repressed housewife into astrology and esoterica like theology. And her dad, a Jewish orphan adopted by Jesuit fur trapper priests in French Canada, owned diners. One was called the Teepee and located in a concrete teepee-shaped building in Long Beach, California. The other was the Ground Roundup on Van Nuys Boulevard in San Fernando. Money was tight for my mom's family. Times were tough.
You grew up in poverty. You said you didn't have a doll.
I had dolls. I didn't have shoes or socks. I had to wear my brother's old socks, and my shoes had holes in them, and I put cardboard in the shoes. I made all my own clothes as a kid. My mother taught me to sew by 11.
In 1959, there was a nuclear meltdown at the Rocketdyne Nuclear Facility in Santa Susana, California, a few miles from where my mom and her family lived in Granada Hills. For 2 weeks, radiation poured over the San Fernando Valley. Now, this meltdown was covered up. It was never cleaned up. It's still sitting there. And it was overseen by former Nazi scientist Wernher von Braun, who was brought to the U.S. by the government in the covert Operation Paperclip in 1945. So when this happened, my mom was young. She was 18. And she had married her childhood sweetheart because she was pregnant. And the radiation caused my mom to have a stillborn baby. So my mom was totally traumatized. It's 1959, and she was completely shamed for having this stillborn baby. It was a time when women were blamed for anything that went wrong, or, you know, just blamed for everything. That was the 50s. My mom was bursting with artistic tendencies. So she fled the oppressive San Fernando Valley, just left this 18-year-old husband, left her family, left the shame, and she took a bus up to Berkeley California, where her best friend was going to college, UC Berkeley, and they went over to North Beach. It's 1960. It's ground zero for the beatniks, who would create the world-famous historic San Francisco counterculture and the iconic Haight-Ashbury.
Now, at this point, we're going to leave Golden Gate Park to go into and take a slight sojourn through the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco.
So in order to understand why and how my parents are who they are, it's important for us to understand the political and societal culture of the 1960s. And who better to explain it other than my BFF's dad, Dennis McNally. He's an author, historian, and the former publicist for the Grateful Dead.
Well, San Francisco has always been a place that was hospitable to the weird, to strangeness. Going back to the way it started, which was not in any conventional way, but because of a gold rush. So by 1960, it was politically still a relatively conservative, a bunch of Republicans. But, for instance, it had become the home of the beat scene, where Allen Ginsberg had read Howl for the first time. And the beat scene, what they were doing was basically opting out of the American value system by sort of going, in a sense, going underground. And they smoked pot, and they listened to jazz, and they, you know, thought their thoughts. There was just this bubbling cauldron, frankly, of avant-garde arts groups. There was room for cultural strangeness.
At the center of this bubbling cauldron of the 1960s San Francisco was my bohemian beatnik artistic mom. So she says that the scene of the counterculture bohemians, the people who formed the counterculture, was small, was about 200 people. My mom was friends with everyone who became someone. My mom's the kind of person who will just casually mention, "Oh, that time Jack Nicholson came over for Thanksgiving." And you're like, "Wait, what? What?" My mom dated Pigpen, who was part of the Grateful Dead. She chauffeured Mimi Farina to ballet class. She also provided Janis Joplin with her signature fur hat.
Oh, the hat. Yeah, well, I don't know, Janis, it was at a North Point house, and Janis floated in with an entourage and said, I don't know what I'm going to wear. So I always wore a rabbit fur hat. And so I said, here, wear this.
She's photographed in tons of pictures in her hat.
I know.
So now that my parents are older, I've become the appreciative and surprised audience at these little anecdotes my parents will drop about major historic events they were part of. Oh, like my mom dropping the random fact that in 1964, she was in the second row at the Beatles' Cow Palace show. That was opening night for the Beatles' first ever concert tour of North America. Oh, and there's my mom in the second row. No big deal. Like, wait, what, Mom?
They only sang halfway through one song, and then there was, like, complete insanity. The audience started pushing forward, and the seats started bending. And
sounds scary.
It was.
So when my mom arrived in North Beach, she quickly met her second husband. He sheltered her and her college chum from a creepy junkie who wanted to, you know, was hassling them. My mom's second husband was a fairly well-known mid-century modern jeweler and beatnik. Cohabitating couples were totally frowned upon in the 60s, so my mom married him.
He had lots of friends in the jazz world, playing at the jazz clubs, so we would go to the Black Hawk Jazz Club and the Jazz Workshop.
That's so cool.
That was cool.
Like pioneers, oddballs, and innovators, jazz came out west as well. It arrived in San Francisco becoming a thing sometime after San Francisco's 1934 waterfront labor strike called Bloody Thursday, when dock workers became the first union to reluctantly integrate. Because of blue-collar jobs on San Francisco's waterfront and a shift from banking to industry during World War II, there was a massive migration of African Americans to San Francisco. Over 600% population increase between 1940 and 1945. By 1950, over 43,000 African Americans lived in the city, and the jazz clubs boomed. The Jazz Workshop, located in North Beach, my mom's neighborhood, was central to the action. Between 1961 and 64, a number of Live at the Jazz Workshop albums were produced. My mom's other hangout, the Black Hawk, was a famous jazz club located in what's now the Tenderloin District, a short but calf-strengtheningly hilly walk from North Beach.
Tell us about Dizzy. Dizzy Gillespie.
Dizzy was, Dizzy would come over and made us breakfast once. And then I saw the recipe in the Lincoln Center recipe book. The same recipe. It was very odd, it was a very southern, like, scrambled egg recipe with salmon, green pepper, and grits. So it was something I had never eaten. And, we went every night to see Dizzy. He was amazing. And he was just really jolly. He was Catholic. So he was trying to be really good with his wife and not get in trouble. He was a funny guy. Yeah.
Did you sleep with him?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
My mom and her second husband, the jeweler, would go to the jazz greats' hotel rooms, and they would fashion ornate rings for them, and they would also smoke pot. My mom says that at the beginning of the 60s, everyone in the beat scene was smoking pot, but it was pretty underground.
Everybody was really afraid to turn anybody on or show anybody what they were doing. It was cloaked in fear. It changed with the music. When the music changed and people got dancing, and it got a lot looser, because the culture of the 50s and before that, it was all about suffering and you have to suffer. And then we decided in the 60s that actually life should be beautiful and life should be laughing and dancing and, so hey, you guys, we're just going to be like, go on our own path and have a good time.
The jeweler taught my mom how to make her own jewelry. Her best-selling piece was a Jesus on a cross with a giant erection. That's my mom. Before she was able to make money with her jewelry, she had a lot of other weird jobs, lots of little odd jobs. She was a belly dancer for a gay, gypsy, refugee from the Holocaust who was a sword swallower. Okay? And together, they would perform at galas for the wealthy. Another one of her gigs, my favorite, was at the Domino Club on Kearney Street in San Francisco. She posed nude on a chaise lounge, and a famous artist painted her on black velvet and auctioned the painting off to the gentleman crowd. She loved this job because, strangely, no one ever hit on her. Later, she realized that the nude models were a cover for a gay club. My mom was also an engineer at KMPX, which was the country's first rock radio station owned by Big Daddy Tom Donahue. Big Daddy Tom Donahue had all the men be the DJs, and all the women were behind the scenes as the engineers running the show. Because the women weren't totally stoned, and they could keep their shit together. Now, because my mom was from L.A., she knew how to drive, and she would chauffeur the rock stars from the airports to their crash pad. Now, that job also came with the task of delivering pot to the rock stars, as the performers all got a big satchel of weed with their payment. Here's your crash pad and your pot. We'll see you at the show. Oh, ridiculous.
Did you ever sell pot in the 60s?
Did I?
Yeah.
No, hash.
Oh.
Sold hash.
Where'd you get it?
I started bringing up all the stuff I had when I was a kid. I had a stamp collection. So I traded my stamp collection for a couple of pounds of hash.
What? How come you only did it once?
I didn't have any more stamp collections.
My mom was deeply involved with the San Francisco improv comedy scene in the early 60s. Because she was a whiz typist, she was the secretary for the committee comedy troupe. She was also the secretary for The Family Dog, which was the rival production company to Bill Graham Presents. My mom even helped the legendary comedian Lenny Bruce slog through his obscenity trial. In the early 60s, Lenny Bruce was arrested multiple times for his vulgar and sexual material. He used words like cocksucker on stage. Shocking at the time, you guys. So Lenny Bruce hired my mom to type up his notes, which were handwritten while he was on the toilet, because he was a junkie, and junkies spend a lot of time in the bathroom. So Lenny Bruce would be on the toilet and writing his obscenity trial, stuff the toilet paper under the door for my mom to transcribe.
Yeah, and he kept saying, in his records that I was typing for him,
words can't hurt anybody, you know, and it set up a story about, you know, so if you call somebody a cunt or you call them a cocksucker, they're not really, you're just using words, they're just words. And the judge wouldn't buy it. They wouldn't buy it. They still sent him to jail.
You mentioned, you told me once that after that trial, the obscenity trial, people started saying the word fuck in normal day.
Right. Never said it. Right. Never said it. Wouldn't even say God damn it.
So my mom's relationship with her second husband, the jeweler, was volatile. And she left him and fell in love with an actor who later became a well-known TV star. My mom's third husband, the actor, was an extrovert. He invited everyone to their little Telegraph Hill apartment after the comedy shows. My mom would cook, and everyone would dance. They'd play records. It was like the height of this amazing music revolution in San Francisco. While her third husband, the actor, was on the road with the Rolling Stones and their groupies, she retaliated by having an affair that resulted in a surprising pregnancy. She'd been sterile for 8 years since her stillborn. My sister's biological father abandoned my mom, and she settled down with her baby, my future big sister, in a fisherman's cottage in North Point, a neighborhood known for the famed Ghirardelli Square. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and you're listening to Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back. Now, the mid-60s were a volatile, transformative time in the world, particularly the U.S. 1965, the Vietnam War is in full swing, drafting 35,000 kids a month. In L.A., the Watts race riots explode between police and African-American neighborhoods. And in 1966, U.S. troops in Vietnam are 400,000. Anti-war protests are growing, the Black Panthers are founded, and West Coast acid manufacturing king Owsley is busted for the first time. 1967 is the Monterey Pops Festival, the Detroit race riots, and huge Vietnam War protests occur in San Francisco, New York, and D.C. 1968, Nixon wins the presidency. Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated. The rock musical Hair, all about the Vietnam War and hippies, opens on Broadway. This is a long way from the 1950s era of repression, saw cops, and Elvis.
The last 18 months has seen a tremendous increase of the so-called hippies. It is the belief of the people who live within the area that we, the middle class or the upper class, have done a very, very poor job in running our government and our way of life.
Thousands of young people are pouring into San Francisco, into the Haight-Ashbury neighborhood. And the press call these young people the hippies. Here's our historian, Dennis McNally.
The people who lived in the Haight-Ashbury did not call themselves hippies. They called themselves freaks. Hippie was a word created by the newspapers because freak, it had edges to it. And the newspapers just didn't like it. It wasn't a word they liked to use. Whereas hippie sounded sort of soft and adorable. And so they made that up and it worked. And everybody used it has used it ever since. Hippie scene frequently gathered together in large groups, and you know, going up to Woodstock and you name it. They gathered around rock and roll, and they used LSD instead of just smoking pot. And the LSD, there's some kind of connection between LSD and rock and roll, which is to say, it makes you sensitive to that incredible sensory overload that you can get from really loud music. And, you know, it just sort of, it takes you somewhere. And there was this guy named Owsley in the San Francisco Bay Area who was really obsessive. And in the end, he produced what was probably the purest and strongest LSD ever made. And he had lots of very interesting and slightly strange theories about what he was doing and why, you know, you had to do certain things. But the end result was he produced literally millions of hits of LSD.
LSD. No 1960s counterculture story is complete without it. Along with notable acid manufacturers like Owsley, Stanford University is manufacturing acid in the early 60s and in the late 50s to test out. They have no idea what it does. Stanford University is located in Palo Alto, which is the home of many of the 1960s musicians. So somehow this acid is making it up to North Beach, and my mom's second husband, the jeweler, has a hookup. He gets Stanford acid, and what people are supposed to do is take the Stanford acid and then write a trip report and return it to Stanford so they can find out what happens when you take acid. That's how my mom started taking acid in the early 60s. It was Stanford acid, so, you know, probably pretty great. I mean, that's some Ivy League acid.
He got me a dose, or gave me a dose, and then he went to sleep. Yeah, so this is my first acid trip in this little fisherman's house in North Beach. But it was great because I zoomed back, you know, to when I was 3 and 4 years old, and my father was super abusive to my brother, and I was terrified. So I went through that experience, but as an older person, so I wasn't so terrified, so it helped heal me. Reliving those experiences of fear and saying, I can deal with this now. I'm in my adult body instead of my child body. And that was my first acid experience.
While my mom was being radiated in LA's never cleaned up nuclear meltdown, running away to San Francisco and nude modeling for gay men, my dad was growing up in Brooklyn in a middle class, intellectual, atheist, Jewish, communist, art loving family. Throughout the 1960s, a new wave of immigrants was starting to move into New York City. As American immigration laws relaxed and white residents moved out to the suburbs, New York City was turning into a multicultural metropolis unlike the world had ever seen. Across the decade as a whole, people all over New York, like the rest of the country, were fighting for change. New York City in the 60s saw countless strikes and protests, sometimes boiling over into violence. Now, let's also remember the 1960s are 15 to 20 years after World War II. Every adult had gone through World War II in some way. New York City is full of refugees and survivors. My dad's mom fled the Ukrainian pogroms from the 30s, and her siblings were murdered in the Holocaust. So New York City is full of humans with what today we call PTSD. My dad was the youngest of three children. His dad was a Rembrandt scholar, a book designer, and his Russian immigrant mom stayed at home. Although later in life, she had her own art gallery in the Berkshires near Tanglewood in Massachusetts. My dad's family lived in Brooklyn, and my whip-smart dad was skipped a few grades, causing him to be the smallest kid in high school, an easy target for bullies. His grandparents, my great-grandparents, lived upstairs, and he played in the streets with his cousins. He went to summer camp in the Berkshires. He had a dog, and, well, he was, for the most part, a happy kid. According to my dad, life was uneventful until 1963, when he started at Brooklyn College, because that's when he met the Sugar Bowl Man.
The Sugar Bowl Man, he completely changed the direction of my life.
And here I am, and I pull up this giant BSA Lightning rocket. Already parked there is a Triumph single-cylinder 500.
My dad is really into motorcycles at this point in his life.
And there's this guy leaning on this bike, and he's 6'5". And I pull up in my big time bike, and I'm 5'8", and he nods at me, says, nice bike. Want to come over to my place and smoke a joint?
So the Sugar Bowl Man is also a nice Jewish Brooklyn boy. He's super tall, has a deep voice, and he introduces my dad to a whole new world.
So the Sugar Bowl, I get over to his house, and the apartment was dark and had all sorts of hanging things, hanging tapestries and little water lights and sort of cushions on what was more relaxing than a couch, you know, I guess pillows. I basically walked into the Brooklyn Casbah.
And the sugar bowl man, I mean, he's got incredible pot. Never smoked anything like it. And he's got lots of it. He tells me, here, hey man, you want to try DMT? And sure, I mean, why not? Well, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is the center of a 500 mic acid trip before you get the pipe out of your mouth from a toke. And man, just a rocket ship ride, and in 15 minutes, you're straight again. You're straight again. It's like, whew, where was I? You know, I went through the doors of perception so fast, it was like light speed. Anyway, but I was completely enamored by psychedelics. And there I had the opportunity. And so what I started to do was, I mean, I realized pretty quickly that, fuck, one, it costs money to do this. And two, if I got two joints, I could sell one and pay for one to smoke myself for free. That was sort of the initial concept of it. And then the DMT, and it costs money. So I ended up sort of passing it out at Brooklyn College.
Were you living with your mom?
I was living at home with my mom. I was bringing all my friends over to trip. We'd be up all night. And my mom would say, hey, I've got bagels and lox for you here in the morning. She'd wonder what the fuck we were doing. It's not like we talked about it. We'd just be up there listening to music and tripping all night. All the time. It was so great and so much fun, and so the drugs were so amazing. They were so clean. I could be able to pass them out to my friends, and it would pay for me to take whatever, and what the fuck, I even made money. And all of a sudden, it was pretty good money. I mean, it just sort of all happened organically. The Sugar Bowl Man is the supplier. I mean, the Sugar Bowl Man had the best drugs I'd ever had. And the acid was made by Nikki Sand, Mr. Sunshine.
Nikki Sand, a.k.a. Nikki Sunshine, a.k.a. Mr. Sunshine, childhood friend of the Sugar Bowl Man, was another disciple of LSD and wanted to manufacture as much as possible to enlighten the world. And Nikki Sunshine's extensive LSD operation was funded by Trustafarian Billy Hitchcock, a descendant of the robber baron family, the Mellons, as in Carnegie Mellon. Now, Nikki Sunshine's patron, Billy Hitchcock, had a mansion in Millbrook, New York. This was the site of world-famous acid tests and mega hippie ragers, lorded over by none other than Dr. Timothy Leary, former Harvard professor and pioneering acid tester. From what I understand from our signature historian, Dennis McNally, Millbrook was insane.
Leary got booted out of Harvard, and he connected with a fabulously wealthy guy by the name of Billy Hitchcock. Anyway, he was a stunningly wealthy guy. And Billy Hitchcock decided that he really liked LSD. And when Leary got booted out of Harvard, he ended up at their mansion, at the mansion that Billy owned in Millbrook, New York. And people started going there. At first, it was like sort of esoteric jazz musicians. They decided they would find artists to share this LSD with. And then it became, you know, sort of more and more people. And eventually, they started getting harassed by a guy named Gordon Liddy, who was a local investigator for the DA of that county. And of course, Gordon Liddy later became part of the Watergate conspiracy, but that's a whole side story. And they talked about LSD, and they gave it a lot of publicity. You mentioned Nikki Sands. Nikki Sands, although also known as Nikki Sunshine, he was a true believer in LSD, and he created what was called Orange Sunshine. And made lots and lots and lots of that. And then when the police went after him, he did a very successful vanishing act and got away with it for about, I think, 25 years. And eventually they caught up with him. There's a whole amazing pattern of people deciding that A, that they liked the LSD and that they found it a useful thing, and then B, people rising up to meet that demand. It's American capitalism at its finest.
My dad never got caught up in Millbrook, but through the Sugar Bowl Man, he did enjoy Nikki Sands' premier acid, Orange Sunshine, and he enjoyed a lot of it. He was running around New York with his chums, a guy we're calling the cameraman, and the jazz man, and this guy named Gnome.
I mean, all I knew was it was fucking great, and we were having a grand time, and we were listening to great music all the time. I mean, we were just tripping out everywhere.
Where? Bagel shops?
Museums? Just the streets. And the cameraman says, oh, let's go up to my dad's house in Woodstock one weekend in the middle of the winter there. It was, I don't know, January, February of 67. Was me, the cameraman's house, his dad's house, Gnome, and this other crazy guy, Steve. But he was really nuts and loved to trip out, and he had broken his leg. And we all went up there, and he went up with a broken leg. It's the middle of winter, there's snow everywhere. And I've got the acid. But it was fucking fabulous shit. And these were 500 mic tabs, beautiful little purple berries. And so the four of us drop a tab, and really strong, but absolutely clean and wonderful. And, you know, I mean, so strong you couldn't do anything. Put your head in a pillow. And I would just watch blueberries float by. As the blueberry would float by, it would say blueberry or strawberry. We went the whole night, you know, and we're tripping out through the morning. Naturally, I said, so let's drop some more. Everybody said, okay, that sounds cool. And I said, well, you know, we're going to have to drop two tabs this time because one won't get us off after last.
Oh, no.
So we all dropped two.
Oh, no. What happened?
It was twice as blueberry. So by late 66, I was taking acid, you know, and psychedelics so often that I finally said, oh, fuck school, and I quit college and decided to major in acid 101.
This is a big deal. My dad was young, fit, ripe for the draft. A few months after quitting school, he got the dreaded letter from Uncle Sam.
Anti-war demonstrators protest U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War in mass marches, rallies, and demonstrations. Central Park is the starting point for the parade to the U.N. building. The estimated 125,000 Manhattan marchers include students, housewives, beatnik poets, doctors, businessmen, teachers, priests, and nuns. Makeup and costumes were bizarre.
My dad had a plan. The night before my dad's draft board interview, he took acid and stayed up all night so he'd be really spaced out for the draft board. At the draft interview, my dad refused to disrobe or pee in a cup, so they sent him to the psychiatrist, who declared my dad 1Y, which is just above 4F. 1Y means Uncle Sam may call again, but probably not. My dad was free. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and you're listening to Disorganized Crime. We'll be right back.
Many predict that there'll be no beautiful summer for the hippies of San Francisco, that the dreamy bohemia of Haight-Ashbury will be destroyed like the beat generation of the 50s by thrill-seekers, tourists, and commercial exploiters. The psychedelic love generation of the 60s may find that it takes more than new words and new drugs to conquer the old order.
It's 1967. The summer of love is in full swing.
The summer of 67 was madness. What happened to the Sugar Bowl Man was that I mean, he was just really easy and loose, and he was really supplying, I guess, a lot of big stuff. And apparently one of his old friends got busted and dropped a dime on him, ratted on him. And it scares the shit out of him. And he retires because everything changed. The CIA came. Well, they had been in there, but they started fucking with the acid all over the place. So they were putting strychnine in the acid, and everybody was getting on bad trips. But what we were getting in New York was just bad acid. And it was a weird time by late summer 67. We were just making a lot of noise and all sorts of political shit, right? And the war in Vietnam, music was changing the world. And the basis for all of that was the drugs that turned on the brilliant people who made the music, who made the art, who created the stuff. So those who were involved in that, they were on a terror tear.
Now, did the CIA tamper with acid? Whether true or not, there was plenty of propaganda circulating, according to Dennis McNally.
I've never seen any credible evidence that the CIA literally poisoned psychedelics. There obviously were people who made psychedelics without the care and attention of an Owsley so that you'd get lesser stuff. But what the CIA did very consciously is poison the atmosphere, and not as much the CIA as the FBI, poisoned the atmosphere in which you were taking LSD, so that if you plant rumors, there were the two that I remember in particular was of the person who took LSD and then stared at the sun until they were blind. There were rumors about people taking LSD and then jumping off, thinking they could fly, jumping out of windows and dying. And those stories are almost whenever you try to research that stuff, you discover that most of it is fraud. But it was definitely, no question, disseminated and put out by the FBI. So they tried to poison the well, at least metaphorically.
Both of my parents say that by the summer of love in 1967, the true spirit of the psychedelic revolution was over. My dad didn't want to live in the city anymore, and he moves up to Stockbridge, Massachusetts. There, he becomes a humble candle maker and burns down his house when he leaves a pot of piping hot wax on the stovetop.
Were you stoned when you burned the house down?
I mean, we smoked a lot of pot. At one point, I invented the first electric pot bomb. I had an pipe that was heated electrically with something to cook the pot, and then it went through the air pump and into your mouth.
In Stockbridge, Massachusetts, my dad hung out with his friend, the cameraman. And through him, my dad ended up appearing as a featured extra in the 1969 hippie cult classic film Alice's Restaurant with Arlo Guthrie. This led to a brief career as an assistant director in New York City film. And then his first hash trip opportunity arises in 1968. The cameraman tells my dad about a guy interested in trading a Lotus Elan, which is a fancy sports car, for 2 pounds of Lebanese hash. So my dad goes to the hash guy, tells him the Lotus guy will trade 3 pounds of hash for the car. The hash guy's psyched. He agrees. And my dad clears 1 pound of hash for profit. It's a winter snowstorm, and my dad in his VW Bug is smoking hash and driving the 2 pounds of hash to the Lotus guy when the pipe falls in my dad's lap. In the skirmish to put out the burning embers, my dad veers off the road into a snowbank. And the state police appear. My dad is quietly freaking out. His VW Bug, stashed with 2 pounds of hash, is stuck in the snowbank in a blizzard. My dad is totally stoned. His crotch is burning. Not an ideal situation for a drug-smuggling, draftable, young, dark, olive-colored man. Luckily, the police want to get out of the snowstorm as fast as possible and incredibly help my dad free his VW from the snowbank and, unaware of the illegal drugs, send him on his merry way. This is just the start of my dad's good luck in the smuggling industry.
So this is your first big deal. How did it make you feel?
It was great. Are you kidding? It was so great. It was really exciting, and we had a pile of money again, and, you know, and it was cool, you know, and fuck, I'm selling candles for $3 a candle or whatever the fuck, and living like a pauper, you know, and then here I was, you know, back to being cool again and free. I mean, money is freedom.
In 1970, my dad decides to head out west, where the action is. After dropping off 5 hitchhikers on Berkeley's University Avenue, my dad heads to Marin County, where he crashes on the porch of some Grateful Dead roadies for a couple of weeks. Then he and a buddy decide to go on a road trip to Big Sur to get some redwood burl slabs. That buddy was my mom's brother. My dad, ever an art enthusiast visionary, wants to make redwood tables to sell to the high-end New York City store Hammacher Schlemmer, apparently the fanciest store in New York. In Big Sur, my dad exchanges some Nikki Sunshine acid for 8 burl slabs.
Anyway, I can't
remember. This is the most hippie thing. You're trading acid for a VW bus of redwood slabs.
Right. I mean,
that is hilarious.
The redwood burl guy, named Crazy Richard, gives my dad some of his own acid, and my dad trips his balls off, as he says.
So I start getting really high. And it was great. I mean, it was not uptight. It wasn't physical. It was strictly phenomenally hallucinatory. And not uptight. Not stressful, not speedy, not any of that stuff, but just so high that all you could do is watch. And there you are. You could understand people talking, but you were so high you couldn't speak.
Instead of leaving my dad at SF's General ER, my uncle chooses to leave the New York filmmaker, as my dad is reputed to be, at his sister's house to recover. My mom has a history of helping people come down from bad trips throughout the 60s and 70s.
Brother says, hey, can you take care of him or something? Do you remember any of that?
They said, here, you take care of him.
And what'd you say?
Okay.
Yeah, but you must have said something earlier about how the filmmaker's pretty cute or something.
Did you think the filmmaker was cute?
Had you made...
Yeah. Well, I must have, but...
You must have.
My mom says he was catatonic for 2 months. My dad says 2 days.
You didn't have to help him go to the bathroom and stuff.
No,
nothing like that. I just couldn't.
Stoned.
I couldn't speak. And
for how long?
No.
A long time.
No.
He doesn't remember how long it was out.
How long?
A long time.
She
like a couple weeks or a couple months?
Yeah.
Those are 2 different things.
Regardless, my dad was psychedelically plopped at my mom's fisherman's cottage where she lived with her 1-year-old, my big sister Vertica. My dad never left. Since he had a family, my dad needed to make money. On one hand, his friend, an Academy Award-winning director, invited my dad to LA to work with him. And on the other hand, he was enchanted by my mom, his family, and the inner circle of West Coast psychedelic pioneers in rock and roll. He could move his hippie family from the rock and roll counterculture country living county to the hustle and bustle of Hollywood. Or he could stay in Marin and make big money being his own boss. Film or rock and roll outlaw? It's Sophie's choice for dudes in their 20s, right? So my dad chose smuggling, and my adrenaline-loving parents began a dangerous double life of extreme highs and lows, truly living in a house of cards that could fall apart at any moment. And I was in that house of cards, playing pretend. Little did I know, my parents were also playing pretend. Theirs was a far more dangerous game, though. In the next episode, my dad's first big trip, his first big deal. It involves 700 pounds of Colombian pot, police blackmail, and the Redwood City Jail. We'll dive into that next. Plus some mescaline, a nutcracker, and the outrageous history of reefer madness. I'm Rainbow Valentine, and this is Disorganized Crime. Disorganized Crime, Smuggler's Daughter, is written and recorded by me, Rainbow Valentine. Our producers are Gabby Watts and Taylor Church. Executive producers are Brandon Barr, Brian Lavin, Elsie Crowley, and me at School of Humans, and Connell Byrne and Charles Bryant at iHeartRadio. Our music is by Gabby Lala and Claire Campbell, with original theme by Mark Caron and me. You can find us online at iHeart.com/podcasts.